Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Shannon Doherty.
Hello.
And Jim Brassel.
Hello.
Jim, this is your first time on the podcast. Would you like to give us a little bit of background about who you are and where you're from?
Okay, so I'm a primary school teacher primarily. I've been teaching in primary schools up here in Leeds for 28 years now. In fact, I just got my long service award from my local council, only a couple of years late. Ironically enough, my gift was a clock, so that I can keep track of the rest of the time I've got in my teaching career. But that's me. I'm primarily a primary school teacher, but I've also got the great title of a pedagogy lead at my school. So I get to do lots of research, make sure I'm evidence informed, and pass that on to as many people as I can, really.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's year six you're teaching them in, Jim, is that right?
Yeah, year six, although I've covered every year group, but been with year six now a couple of years, yeah.
What's your favourite?
Favourite year group? I'd probably pick five, actually, because I think they're just at that nice kind of midpoint between, well, obviously four and six, but between a kind of one eye on high school and one sort of foot firmly planted in primary school, really. So I'll probably go five. Yeah.
Nice, good choice. I think I went five whenever Lloyd interviewed me, but it's been a while since that interview. We're almost creeping up on 200, actually. So someone else is going to need to think of some questions. But back to the focus, we're going to explore modelling and in particular effective modelling in the classroom. But first, Shannon, what's you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
Well, I haven't started it yet because it is the Easter holidays and I've been having a well-earned rest. But I fully intend to start Responsive Coaching by Josh Goodrich. Kieran's nodding as I say it, because what Josh doesn't know about coaching isn't worth knowing. And he came and trained our teacher development leads in each of our schools a couple of years ago. And he was excellent then. And he's been writing this book for such a long time. You just know that it's going to be full of wisdom and full of really practical help. And it's been split into like an introduction section, which talks about how to read this book. And then it's got theory, practice and implementation. And I just know it's going to be full of gold. It's like a bit like when Sam Crome's book on Teams came out. You know that someone's been working on it for years. They've got the experience and they've got the expertise and they've done all the reading that there is to do. And it's been distilled into not too thick of a book. So I think it's going to be quite kind of digestible for people. What about you, Jim? What are you reading for?
So I've got two things that I'm currently, attempting to make my way through. I think, like yourself, Shannon, it's not always easy to read during the holidays, isn't it? When you need a sort of well-earned cognitive break from teaching and learning. But I'm currently reading Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. It's a book basically about, well, he calls them systems of thinking. So the first one is based on your kind of heuristics. And by that, I think he means the kind of mental shortcuts that we take a lot of the time to make quick decisions. And the difference between that, which he calls system one thinking, and system thinking, which is essentially taking a bit more time over your decision-making processes and just slowing your thought process down, as far as I can tell. And like we've just said, Kieran, breaking news here, thinking hard takes a lot of effort, which he mentions in the book. And it's also a book that's full of humanity. I think he talks from a really good place. And just before reading the book, I heard his episode of Desert Island Discs, which gives a lovely kind of background to him and his cultural background and why he ended up loving the subject that he does, psychology. So that's a great read. And I was also given by a work colleague a paper, which is called Interleaving Retrieval Practice Promotes Science Learning. I'm nearly at the end of the first paragraph, but it's got a killer first line. And the first line is conceptual learning is the backbone of education. I mean, what a way to start a paper. So I'm expecting great things from that one. That's written by Fari Asana and Veronica Yan from the University of Texas at Austin. And I can send you a link for that too, Kieran, if you wish to put it on show notes or whatever. So, Kieran, what are you reading for?
All sound fantastic. I've got something that's not necessarily education-based, but it might, I suppose, be hinterland if you're teaching science. It's a book called Black Holes. So it's by Brian Cox and Jeff Forshaw. And it is, like I say, not necessarily something you're going to teach per se, but I think it might help with the sort of our understanding of science in general. And it's got this really good contrast on the spine, where you've got these like multicolors, and then obviously it's devoid of color on the rest of it. So yeah, definitely well recommended. I actually had some book vouchers that I had to spend, so I've got 5 not teaching related books to get work my way through that I'm going to share probably over the next month or so. So we're going to explore effective modeling. Shannon, you working in lowercase days too at the minute, am I right?
Yep, I am in year 3 for half the week.
Jim, you're in year 6, so probably we're coming at it from a key stage 2 perspective, but I've spent a lot of time in year 1 and 2. My wife spent a lot of time in year 1 recently, and so I'll try and fill in the blanks there where possible. I think it makes sense to begin with definitions like we normally do. So for the purposes of this conversation, Shannon, how would we define modeling?
I did a little bit of kind of reading in preparation for this, and I think the most helpful definition that I found was that modeling is an instructional strategy where a teacher or an expert demonstrates a concept, process, or approach to students or novices. And I also stumbled upon a really nice article from Andy Tharby at the Durrington Research School, where he talks about modelling, that it sets a benchmark for excellence, it makes the abstract success criteria concrete, and it excavates the thought process of experts. And I just think that kind of covers all basis for what modelling does in the classroom.
Well, as soon as I knew that this episode was about modelling, I immediately thought of behaviours and how we model that all the time, really, just to peers. And to our pupils, you know, in fact, we're kind of modelling all the time, aren't we? We're modelling a form of behaviour. We're modelling curiosity, courtesy, reciprocity in conversation. We greet our pupils every morning at the door with a good morning, kind of, how are you? And it's led to an amazing increase in conversation, just really nice conversation between pupils and teachers and pupils and adults. So that was my first thought when I first knew it was about modelling. But Shannon's hit the nail on the head there in terms of a definition of how a teacher stood at the front of a classroom would use modelling. I think it is that kind of structured format that an expert is using to provide either a concept or a process, some sort of algorithm to novices, and how to do it and how to use the best method to do it in terms of what you're teaching and who you're teaching to, because that's massively important as well. And then when I started thinking about this, I couldn't help but get to the point that there's a huge amount of prerequisites that need to be in place before you even think about modeling something. You have to know your pupils, where they're at, you know, what's their attention like, what's their retrieval strength like, are you at the beginning of a term or the end, or is it the day before the Easter holiday breakup, when your modelling might be, I don't know, more concrete, more explicit than it was 2 weeks previous. So it threw up a lot of things to think about. But in terms of the actual, you know, how to use your whiteboard, whether it's interactive or something you would use to write on with a pen, it's that, isn't it, really, that really structured format of presenting something.
Both of you between you have sort of, like you said, hit the nail on the head. What was the excavation bit there, Shannon? That was brilliant.
It excavates the thought process of experts. And I think if I put on my sort of walkthroughs trainer hat, that is something that when we do training on the live modelling walkthrough, one of the steps is modelling your messy thinking. And it's one of those things that I think is really hard. And we'll probably talk about it later. But I think it's one of those things that's really hard, particularly for a newer teacher, to know just how far you have to take it and how deep you have to dig when it comes to the thought process and the decision making process that you make as like someone further down that expert novice continuum.
Absolutely love it. That's fantastic. What principles guide your modeling, and do they change when modeling concepts and or processes?
Yeah, definitely. You don't mind if I consult my little notebook here, do you, Kieran, as a novice thinking to dap a guest? I've written down, first of all, clarity, being explicit, particularly for my colleague and I. We share a class. We teach a class together for half the week each, basically. We're working this year with a cohort who really appreciate explicitness and clarity and minimal use of teacher talk. And it's funny, you mentioned Shannon. Was it Andy Thalby you mentioned earlier? Because he is a co-author, I think, or he edited Making Every Maths Lesson Count, which I dipped into just before the show, actually. And it's got an absolutely brilliant chapter on modelling and explicit instruction. And it goes through some fantastic real life opportunities that you can, not opportunities, but strategies that you can put into practice in the classroom that really, really work. Everything from isolating the skill to the use of analogy and number lines. And it's got some brilliant stuff in there. But in terms of principles, just to get back to that, I would say clarity is first and foremost, explicitness, really careful use of images. And I know there's lots of research out there, isn't there, about dual coding and how images can be used. But we as teachers, I don't know if you guys are guilty of this, but I certainly in my teaching past used to hurl a huge amount of images at slides that weren't entirely helpful. And I've put thirdly, I've limited it to three really, was the really careful use of language and the sharing of an objective at the beginning of the lesson. So I think those would perhaps be my top three. But again, it depends on what you're teaching. So if it's a mathematical, like a standard algorithm, I would use a different process compared to a concept like prime numbers.
I wish I had limited mine to three. I really tried to get it to a nice little number where it could be kind of snappy, and I've ended up on eight. So my eight kind of guiding principles, and some of them will be similar to yours, Jim. So the first one being, take a step or two back before you take a step forward. A common mistake that I think some of us have made probably, you know, in our earlier career kind of stage was that, you know, you'd go, today's objective is this, therefore I will start with this. But I think, you know, as you read more about how children learn and as you progress in your career, you understand that we really need to make that kind of explicit connection bit to prior knowledge and prior learning. So taking a step back and saying, this is what we've been doing, and then being able to move forward is a really important principle for me. The second one that I've written down is know your onions. And I know that sounds really silly because, of course, you should know what you're teaching. However, like if we think about our job, it is a really tough job. We have to teach a number of subjects. And even as like Jim, we're in a similar situation where I share a class for half a week as well. So I don't have to teach all the subjects. But certainly when I was a full-time class teacher, teaching maths and English every day, and then your science, your geography, your DT, your PE, your art, and so on, it's really hard to know everything about those subjects. However, if you're going to teach effectively, you really do need to know it, and that comes with time and with experience and kind of if you look at kind of Lloyd's model, where they give their teachers a day a term for kind of planning ahead for that subject knowledge planning, you can do it, you can know it, but to really model something effectively, you have to know the ins and outs of it, the intricacies, the misconceptions that might get thrown up, because otherwise it won't be as effective as you need it to be. It's interesting, you talked about kind of that kind of teacher talk aspect of it. And I know for a long time, there's been a lot of talk about kind of minimizing teacher talk. And I prefer to say kind of optimizing teacher talk so that, you know, you are very careful with your language, like you said, Jim. You know the words that you're using, you've prepared what you're going to say as much as you can do without it being kind of going into every hour of your evening or your weekend. But you know the explanation you're giving, and you know how to build on it, you know how to make it kind of hit home with the children. So it's not necessarily about talking less, but it's about making your words as effective as they can be. Another thing that I think is really important is breaking it down and breaking it down again. We think that it might be broken down into small steps, but it probably isn't. And you need to really think about how you can chunk it up for your kids because they are newer to it and they're novices and they really do need it in that kind of bite-size kind of incremental progress. With that, I've sort of said never underestimate the need for more examples. Always have more up your sleeve than you think that you're going to need. I know, part of my job involves watching teachers and giving feedback and coaching. And something I probably talk to most teachers about is the need for more examples. You know, three examples probably isn't going to cut it. Have more ready because there's going to be someone that doesn't quite have it, or a misconception will get thrown up that you weren't quite ready for. So you might have some on the slides, depending on how people work. I quite like to have things, under the visualizer, and I might have a kind of a sheet of paper to off the kind of camera to say these are my examples that I would like to do in this order, or what misconception might get thrown up. And if it's something I've taught quite often, then I'll be able to do that without making notes. But certainly when I was a newer teacher, I'd need to make notes around different examples I was using, and being ready to kind of bring those in, because otherwise you get to empty, you've got nothing left in the tank, and you think, oh, I can't just come up with an example on the spot, because lots of teachers can't. And I guess that kind of goes with knowing your onions. Planning for that handover, I know Tom Sherrington talks about it a lot, that I do, we do, you do. It should be an extended handover. It shouldn't just be I do, I do, I do, you do, you do, you do. It's a lot of back and forth. It's a lot of working together. That is the important bit. That's where the learning's going to happen, that kind of holding their hand through it. Make really small adjustments between examples. So making sure that kind of those deep structures are similar, but kind of changing surface level stuff so that they're getting used to it. Slightly different context, but really it's the same. So that they're getting that kind of repeated practice again and again. And then my last one is kind of beware the curse of knowledge. You are an expert, as a teacher, you have to make things really explicit. If you've decided to use a word, or you've put an apostrophe somewhere, or you've drawn a diagram in a certain way, tell them why, because it's not inherently clear to them, and they'll be better off for it. So those were my eight guiding principles.
Nice. I mean, yeah, if we wanted to go for 11 ways to improve your modeling, I'm not sure how many people would stay with us, but I think they're fantastic. And you both mentioned talk. And I really like your reframing, Shannon, in terms of optimizing, because I mean, that's certainly the sense that I got, Tim, from your sort of explanation of it, was that that's essentially what you're trying to do. I call it be more Shakespeare, which is probably the worst way to describe it because no one knows what that means, because apparently Shakespeare didn't waste a single word in any of his books, but I couldn't possibly tell you if that's true or not. What does that mean for your decision making when you're thinking about what you say? Because I've got an idea of what it means, but if anyone's listening, it probably makes sense to start with you, Jim. What are they, what can they do to consider how best to optimize their talk in the classroom during their explanations and their modeling in particular?
Okay, well, if I can just give a mention to particularly concerning maths, the polysemous word, of which there are many in maths, that would be one thing to really sort of carefully curate. Like if you're asking pupils to draw a table, it's it could be a dangerous question for some, unless there's that clarity. So I think one thing to consider would be just have in mind, know your onions, like you've said, Shannon. Know what the words mean. Perhaps delve into a little bit of their etymology. I know you've mentioned before, Kieran, I think, was it the division symbol that you talked about in terms of its history and looking like a sword and so on? Is just to give those words that pupils might not be familiar with a bit of background and a bit of history. We're hardwired for narrative, so a bit of story there too. We use a lot in our school the sentence stem, which is a really powerful way of, I think, firstly presenting your information, allowing pupils to use it, and then that talk becomes hopefully internalized for them. so that over time they end up framing the sentences as you would like them to frame the sentences. And there are some brilliant ones out there. We use White Rose Maths as a scheme that provides some excellent sentence stems for us to use. So if I was to pick two, I'd go for polysemous words and just being really clear and focused about how you're using the words, and also sentence stems. Yeah, providing a concrete model of how you want pupils to frame their talk. And I know you've mentioned as well, Shannon, about being really clear about providing examples and having lots and lots of examples. Can we also give a shout out to the non-concept, the sort of non-example? It's such a powerful tool. And I'm going to refer to the book again. It's Emma McRae's, isn't it? I think Making Every Maths Lesson Count. There's a fantastic page of triangle examples, some really good outliers. And she argues that rather than providing a definition first, we provide examples first and really get to know those deeply before going anywhere near any sort of formal definition of, well, I've picked triangles because this is one of my favourite lessons, I think. Yeah, be aware of polysemous words and frame the talk for the pupils. Sentence stems are immensely powerful, and they also help to clarify a teacher's thinking about the objective too, because it makes you refocus on how you want pupils to actually talk about the subject that you're teaching.
On the division symbol, the etymology can be a dangerous thing. So I almost try and qualify my sources by, if this is going to be helpful to my pupils, then I'm going to buy into it. If I trust the source enough, because a lot of these things, lots of the mathematical terminology and symbols were sort of, it was 15th, 16th century clerics who were making these decisions based on older sources, if that makes sense. And some of the stories go way back, because I'm pretty sure at some point the division symbol was runic in nature, and it was almost like this Scandinavian dagger for cutting fish up into smaller pieces. But it's been so long since I read that I can't remember exactly who said that. So my judgment is, if this helps with my exposition, then I'm going to lean into it. Like, I think zero is contested, but I even wrote about it in Thinking Deeply About Primary Mathematics, about the emptiness and the traders rubbing it into the sand and stuff. Now, Marcus de Sautoy was my source for that, but it may be that he was wrong. But I think, yeah, I think it's really important, because, you know, if it aids exposition, then, you know, the 100% accuracy, it's not going to hurt people in the long run. Yeah, so I think that makes a whole lot of sense.
I just wanted to add, like, I think the points about vocab and stem sentences are really, really important. And I think so much of that comes from being prepared, which can be really hard when you're so busy and you've got so much to teach. But if you can take even just like 2 minutes before the start of the day and think about, what vocabulary must I pre-teach today? Because the value of pre-teaching that vocabulary before you start an explanation is, you know, you can't underestimate it. Because I'm sure we've all done it, where we've been reading a book or we've been giving an explanation and you say a word and you think, oh, I now need to explain that word. And that's stopping my explanation or stopping the flow of what I'm reading. And that's going to impact their kind of understanding of what I'm saying. I'm going to have to go back to what I was started, back to the start, so that they get it. I think it's so important to be prepared. And I think if you want to kind of optimize your explanation and that exposition, you need to know what words are going to come up, and you need to have, I'm not saying rehearse it constantly, but I do think it's important that you've planned what you're going to say. And that, again, that might sound stupid to some people, but there are definitely times where you're so time poor, or people feel like they have got too much to juggle, that the planning of an explanation falls to the wayside. And that's like the most important part, is knowing your examples and your explanation to go with it, so that the children really do get it. And I also really just want to highlight again that kind of using those non-examples, using misconceptions as teaching points, rather than letting them happen later, because you've missed a trick there. And again, you then have to go back, rather than saying, oh, you might be tempted to do this, or let's look at this, why is this not right? That sort of thing is really powerful, I think, when you're modelling.
I think Neil will be nodding along at the non-examples as well, especially the triangles, because he's been using that in our most recent talk when exploring sort of variation theory and direct instruction. Just as an aside, Shannon, are you mentioned you noticed a lot of the same things in conversations you were having with teachers. Now, both of my books came from having similar conversations with lots of people over time. Are you writing these down somewhere? Because I would highly recommend it, because then the book will write itself for you.
I'm not writing them down. Perhaps after this, I will go and start keeping a diary of these conversations, because these can come up again and again, and I just think, oh, let's do something with this. And actually, where I do think it's useful, I'm fortunate to work with a local ITT provider, and I do a few kind of training sessions for them each year. And I do a bit with our ECTs, and so I can say to them, this comes up, don't let this, don't let this happen to you. But it's weird, as we were driving home from Winchester today, I was thinking about this episode and thinking, oh, maybe there should be a little kind of guide for early career teachers or people further down the line even, and say, these are things that keep coming up again and again, and this is really important. Don't let this Don't let this happen to you. Don't let this thing fall to the wayside, because it's crucial for children's understanding, which is at the end of the day why we're doing this job.
I'm looking forward to that book. I mean, someone really wise told me that when I started my last project, and now I think I'm hopefully going to interview her next week. There's a really excellent maths lead called Samantha, who is doing basically my job, but in the Northeast with three schools in the Northeast. And I was able to go, look, here are all the mistakes I made. Try and avoid the doing what I did in 2017. So yeah, it might be even just be useful in that respect. So, I mean, have you or do you ever have to adopt your modeling for others? And you can interpret that as you choose.
I was just going to ask actually, Kieran, for a little bit of clarification about your question there, because I wrote the question down. Do you ever have to adapt your modelling for others? Do you mean so that other people present what you've planned and put together, or do you mean to present to a different group of pupils or people or?
It's a really good point. I had pupils in mind, but I wasn't sure how
Okay.
to classify. I didn't want to put limits on the type of pupils or the group of pupils that you might be changing for. But I think both questions are really interesting, so let's go for both of them if possible.
Okay, so, well, in the past, obviously, I've planned resources and lessons for other year group teachers to use. But the problem with that is, and it's not necessarily a problem, but an issue to consider would be you're not there. So you're not getting the instant feedback that you would be if you were stood at the front of the classroom. They've been obviously carefully put together and sequenced. But you're not there assessing the understanding, checking for understanding. You're not there getting that instant feedback. It's very difficult to judge the pace when you don't know that group of learners. So that's one thing to consider, I think. And also, and this came up during lockdown when I was teaching via Teams, and obviously had put together very, very carefully sequenced lessons on PowerPoint with, parts of an algorithm would come flying into the screen and bang on time, and I would be voicing over. But I couldn't use gesture. I couldn't stop and look at the group and kind of read the room, if you like. So that was an issue. And I think that kind of live, if we're talking about modeling, that kind of live modeling is something that needs consideration as well. And are we going to talk about Bansho today? Because and I probably misread this or misunderstood it, but is Bansho, am I correct in thinking it's kind of how do you use your board when you're live modeling? I think because my Bansho is pretty poor. I'll get to the end of a lesson and walk out the door and walk back in 5 minutes later after a break and look at the board and think, oh my goodness, who has scribbled on this board? It's the least clear in terms of, and if you wanted to use it for an explanation, it's fairly splurgy and kind of all over the place, but it was useful at the time. So I don't know if that's something to consider as well, that kind of skill of where exactly do you write on your whiteboard, how do you use utilize it as best you can. So I think I've maybe answered the question. So it's a definite yes. Do you make your modeling different for different groups of people? Well, yes, because you're kind of checking for understanding all the time and assessing your next step as a teacher a lot, I think, in a classroom. So I've certainly modeled it differently and presented it differently and done that. Planning for a different year group is a really good discipline, but it really does lack that feedback in the moment and your sort of knowledge of the pupils.
On the band show, just before you come in, Shannon, I took part in a maths work group. This must have been 2018, and we spent six different sessions across the year exploring band show, and we did it through lesson study, which is not like lesson. What's the big one where you teach someone's class? And is that oh, that is lesson study. This was called learning study. We took six kids, we taught them this idea, and we used our whiteboards and we used color and representation and connections between different things. Then we reflected on it, and then we taught another six, and then we improved. And over that time, we were supposed to get in towards this sort of more refined instruction. And a really interesting thing you said there, from the outside, it might look nonsensical and might look like it's mayhem, but actually it's the meaning that the pupils make through the joining of the different representations. Now, I'm probably doing a really bad job of explaining this. Is one of my colleagues from the hub, Laurie Jakes, who led the group, and she was fantastic. She did her PhD on variation theory, and she really helped us think really carefully about the examples we chose and the connections and the colors and the movement and things. So I think you're absolutely spot on. It's definitely an effective way to consider things, but will it make sense to other people on the outside? Could somebody else pick up from where you left off the day before? I don't think so. I mean, in my experience, I'm just happy if the class were calm and on task during the lessons that I'm not there, because that's probably the first way to pitch your expectations. I don't know if that's what that says about me.
I think most people would agree. I'm just happy if they're calm. I think, Jim, you've touched really nicely on sort of the importance of adapting as you go and being responsive and that feedback in the moment and assessing. And so I'm not going to rehash that. And so I'll think about, I also thought, do we mean for other adults that are teaching or do we mean for children? So I'm going to do a two-pronged answer as well. So adults, obviously I share a class, and I'm not in school with my job share at the start of the week. We don't have any crossover periods unless I make a point of going in on a day that is kind of a teacher development lead day, which I do quite often. But so when I'm thinking about planning for the week, one of us will plan maths, one of us will plan English. And we'll keep in touch about how it's going and kind of adapt as we go. I find myself having to put a lot more into kind of slides when I'm planning for somebody else. And I have to adapt it in that I put a lot more on the page. I put the questions on. I might kind of make things pop up at certain times because I need my thought process of what if I were teaching this, how would this play out? I need that to kind of go onto the page. I've tried it, when I was a teacher in a two commentary school, we tried just making notes alongside the slides or having a discussion about it, but you'd inevitably forget because we're really busy. So I think I end up if I'm adapting it for people, I put a lot more on the page. And I, because I know that it's too much to say, right, the notes that go with this slide are this, and expecting them to kind of learn that is really hard. So, kind of adults aside, thinking about children, I think you know your audience, you know your students best because you're with them, teaching them either if you're a primary school teacher, you're teaching them all day, some of you every day, those of you that are full-time teachers. If you're a secondary teacher, you're teaching them regularly throughout the week or every week in your subject. So you do know your students best. You know who needs what. So again, I think it comes down to being prepared, but also being ready to adapt in the moment. So some of my peoples I know will need kind of the examples in front of them. So I've got a range of needs in my class, and some of them just are better if I have kind of pre-populated a sheet with the examples that are going to come up so that I can point to them and say, right, this is example C. You do that one. It's on the board as well. For some of them, it's enough on the board. For some of them, they did it in front of them. And then on top of that, some of them might need more of a backwards faded approach where I might think that where we are in the sequence, most of the class are okay with just starting at the beginning. Some of them might need to start near the end, and then that gets faded out. So you know your children, just be prepared and then adapt in the moment, I guess. You know, some people will surprise you, some people might need more than you've planned for. So being able to spot that and then act upon it is really important. But I think we do that constantly as teachers. We're constantly adapting and being responsive. People probably think that they aren't doing it as much as they actually are. It's a bit like the classic one of like questioning. People think, oh, I need to ask more questions. You're probably asking hundreds of questions. It's about knowing what you're asking. And with this, you're adapting constantly. It's about knowing why you're adapting. How could you have done that in advance and preempted that maybe? And then just learning from it, I think.
Yeah, I would totally agree with what you said there. And actually, with planning for others in mind, I know you've mentioned writing questions, for example, on whiteboard slides. We've introduced a number of principles recently in our school. Worked examples, for example, cold calling, checking for understanding, formative assessments, some different ways to do it. But at the outset of the CPD that we presented, I said, look, this is not a dogma. It's not a tick list that you have to put in sort of every single lesson. I don't know your teaching style or your pupils or your cultural background or where you're coming from. So here's this kind of checklist rather than a tick list. Use it as you see fit best. You've got agency and ownership and skill and knowledge and obviously, the motivation to do it. Here are some good ideas to use. But it isn't a dogma. You don't have to stick to every single one and tick them off for every single lesson. Use them as you see fit. It was just a consideration that popped into my head just then. Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. I mean, that's probably the clip for Saturday morning, Jim, if I'm being honest. If you've got agency, absolutely, yeah, because everything doesn't work all the time, does it? You need to choose it for the moment you're in, and that and being, that responsive teacher that you guys have been talking about. I mean, if I look at your 11 principles for modeling, it's clear that you've got all pupils in mind throughout all of them. Those small adjustments, that clarity, the careful use of language. Never underestimating the need for different examples and, planning the handover. All of those things will benefit learners, I think, of any age. Because if I think about year one, year two, you've obviously got the burden of reading, which isn't necessarily the case that the older the pupils get. So you have to really think about what language do I want on this board. Because, even if we look at the sort of the phonetic makeup of our numbers, I'm not 100% certain I could pinpoint exactly what's going on in each one of them. And, I've color coded them thinking, oh, is this a split digraph? Is this not? I think your examples do take account of everybody and do take account of others. So it's really clear. So I'm really pleased we got a chance to talk about that handover as well, because it's something, we have there will be times we have to leave the class with someone else, even if we're in there full time, we'll be off at this or off at that or pulled into something else. And so it's definitely worth thinking about because we can feel like there's already not enough time in the day. So it might just add extra pressure if we're stressing about, how well things have gone in our absences as well. And Shannon, you mentioned there the gradual release of responsibility or the gradual fading. What does that mean in your classroom?
I talked earlier about the kind of the I do, we do, you do, and Tom Sherrington's written extensively about that kind of extended handover. And I just think it's really important that it doesn't become sort of that formulaic, here's I've planned three I do examples and three we do examples and three you do examples, because I think what's coming from this discussion is that we want really skilled practitioners and teachers who are able to be responsive and able to adapt, and who know now's a good time to do a we do, or they've got that bit, let's give them a touch more. And we kind of, you know, it's about collaborating and kind of co-constructing answers or co-constructing sentences, and then like that consolidation as well, all comes within that we do handover. And you want to be able to give them more over time, but also know when to kind of pull it back and pull their independence back and say, oh, now I'm going to show you this, because their understanding has progressed that far. So you can pull out those misconceptions, you can pull out the really important aspects of a process or a concept, you can pull out connections to other concepts during that we do bit. So I think there was a time when someone might come into a lesson and say, oh, you were talking for far too long, or your input went on for far too long, the children should have started their work earlier. So I think it's important to kind of reframe it. And I hope lots of people have moved away from that way of thinking, because so much learning is happening during that extended modelling handover. And there's so much gold going on there. And that's really where you see it clicking. So I think I just want to reiterate the importance of, don't be afraid of making that longer than you think that it should be, or that someone might come into your lesson half an hour in and go, oh, why are the children not working in their books? Because there's so much learning happening in that I do, we do, you do, pulling it apart and making it go on until you know they really are ready to go. And that kind of guided practice, I think, is really important for them to be successful with their independent practice and then applying it in later lessons.
I mean, you say there was a time, but it feels very much like that's the kind of thing that's still being said to, you know, solidarity with those who are still in that situation. Remember, there are more schools than teachers at the minute. So, you know, you guys are clearly operating at a really high level. You know, it comes across in everything you say and everything you think about. You know, you're thinking about really sensible approaches to the teaching of pupils, and you know, unfortunately not everyone's in that situation. So I think, yeah, the more you can say that, Shannon, the better, because I think it's extremely important for as many leaders in particular as possible to know. And so I think we've got time for one more. How do you assess the effectiveness of your modeling?
Well, my first thought when I saw this question was, just say formative assessment a lot, and that'll be a really good answer. That'll be a really good answer. But essentially, I think it is. I think it is that formative assessment. But you can vary how you go about doing that. And it involves you as a teacher circulating a room, perhaps, or using whiteboards effectively. And as soon as you mention whiteboards, you know, you enter into the realm of, have you set up exactly how you want your pupils to use those whiteboards, and what are your kind of norms and routines when it comes to whiteboards? And you open up another little rabbit hole that people go that people can go down. But I think it is true to say that checking for understanding in a lesson live is perhaps the most important thing you can do, because it is that bridge between what you're teaching and whether it's been learned or not. And not to be afraid of just taking a step back and changing your modelling. In the book that I dipped into before this evening, Making Every Maths Lesson Count, there's a section on worked examples. And it's absolutely brilliant, because it gives you lots and lots of different types of, like strategy comparison, for example, or faded worked examples. So I think it's I know you've mentioned, Shannon, responsive teaching. I think it is having a little bit of bravery, really, as a teacher, to be able to sort of step back and say, hang on, that perhaps that wasn't the best model. Perhaps I need to use another one. And to step in at that point and actually do it. especially if there's some visitors watching, perhaps at the back of the room, it's about taking that step and actually doing it. So I've only written one thing for this answer here. I've scribbled in my notebook and I've just said formative assessment question mark, checking for understanding. But I think when I went to Research Ed in September and I went to Tom Sherrington's session first thing in the morning, he said two things that really stuck with me. Number one, the classroom is an immensely complex place. Peps McRae reiterated that in the afternoon when I went to see him. And Tom also said, check for understanding because of that complexity. You have to have a kind of handle on what's happening in the room in terms of your teaching and whether it's getting to the point where you would like it to get to. So I guess to sum up, if you need to change the model, change the model.
I too just wrote check for understanding. And I think, for people that are working in that way, that's probably that language of check for understanding is like second nature to us, isn't it? But for anyone who isn't working in that way, or isn't thinking of like kind of a Rosenshine or a walkthroughs or this kind of hat on. It's like you said, Jim, that whiteboard work, that circulation of the classroom, that feedback in the moment, like multiple choice questions. That for me is some of the most exciting stuff that we do. The modelling I love. I love modelling. I love doing an example. I love knowing that I've planned a lovely sequence, but seeing it in action. And being able to jump in and say, oh, like, look at this, or oh, have you thought about this? And assessing them in the moment, because that's where you know that you're having an impact. And I think, yeah, don't underestimate the importance of formative assessment. It blows my mind that there are teachers who aren't in an environment where they're talking about formative assessment more, because like you said, that is the most important thing. And I think it's Inner Drive. There's a lovely graphic about kind of Rosenshine's principles and how they all just feed into checking for understanding. You're questioning because you need to check for understanding. You're modeling, which you then check for understanding. All of them feed into it. And there's a reason that, they're all fitting into that, because it is the most important thing we do. Yes, we model. Yes, we explain. Yes, we scaffold. But if you don't hit that check for understanding mark, then whatever you do next doesn't have any weight, does it? So just constantly check in whichever way you see fit. And that will change. But that's the good stuff. The good stuff is that checking, seeing light bulbs kind of switch on, and then also seeing where they're not and going, I can do that. I can intervene here and I can help. Or knowing when to pull back and say, oh, I'm going to watch you struggle, and that's okay because struggle's important. That's really exciting. And the enjoyable part of a lesson for me is, yes, I love all the modeling. Yes, I love all the explanation, but it's the interacting after and seeing what comes after.
I mean, I think what you guys have demonstrated in this episode is that it is a really complex, I mean, not to overuse the word complex, because obviously classrooms are complex, but I think modeling is complex and there's a lot to think about. It's lots of behaviors that intertwine and meet. And I think you guys have done a really good job of explaining it clearly. Lots of food for thought for those teachers who are already probably modeling really effectively, but especially those who are sort of have an interest in improving their modeling, whether that be because of their novice status or because of them, there's room to improve. So I think it's going to be massively useful. All that's left to do is say thank you very much for joining me. Thank you very much, Shannon.
Thank you for having me back.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Kieran. I've really enjoyed that. Thanks, Shannon.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.